Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 22, delivered on April 16, 2018. The title of this lecture is Project Financing Costs.
Today, project financing costs. This is actually something that affects both companies and individuals with respect to their decisions about whether or not to go ahead with a project. For example, if you buy a house, now there is going to be the loan, but almost always there are going to be fees attached to the loan. And those become part of the cost of the financing. So I'll say I might want to borrow $150,000 for a house, but what I end up borrowing is more than $150,000, unless I want to put the money out of pocket. One way or the other, there's going to be money involved that is not part of what you originally expected to happen. Now, interestingly, and I brought this up once before in the class, but I'll bring it up again. There are these reorg specialists that can take, they say, we're going to save your company from catastrophe. We're going to come in, swoop in, we're going to arrange for financing to get you back on your feet, and we're going to step into your managerial roles to some extent and get your supply chains reorganized so that you've got lower costs of your inputs or your merchandise, wholesale merchandise. And these companies do this at a staggering cost. And I ran into these reorg specialists like that, and I did some reorg, but I didn't do it like this. I would have probably made a fortune. An example would have been a company like Staples. Years ago, Staples was in serious trouble, and it still isn't in great shape, but they were near bankruptcy. And a group that was led, a reorg group that was led by former presidential nominee Mitt Romney stepped in and said, okay, we're going to get you all the money you need to get you back on your feet. We're going to move all of your production to China. We're going to get you the capital to build, make your stores look nicer, close a bunch of them, lay off a bunch of employees, and get you back in Wall Street's graces. So they borrowed for the company, they made the arrangements for a pile of money. I mean seriously large amount of loans. But the company got only about 75% of that money. The rest was these reorg specialists' consulting fees. So the company was saddled with an enormous amount of money, only about three-fourths of which actually had any productive use to the company at all. The rest was simply taken out before the company got its money and put into the bank account of the reorg group, led by, as I said, Mitt Romney. Romney was a specialist at this, and he'd done this for a number of companies. What this does, essentially, is to leave the company with a return on its borrowings that is considerably less than it would be. So think about it this way. If you were to borrow $100 million, and this is a very simplistic example, and that is going to turn into $10 million per year for, let's say, 15 years. And this is, as I said, a very simple example. Okay, that's good. But so we could do a quick, dirty net present value of that, figure out what it is. And I'll see if I can do that real fast. Where's my calculator here? I'll turn this on. Hang on. Let me turn on the documents. TI. Oh, let me turn this on. I'm sorry. Okay. Come on. And if I were to just say apps, is that showing yet? Well, I'm going to do apps finance, and all I'm going to do is the present value of $10 million for 15 years, and let's discount it at 8%. At 8% per year. And the payments are $10 million each. Calculate the present value, alpha solve of that. And I'll show you. Matter of fact, let me take it down. I better do this with something that'll work. 6 alpha solve. Okay, let's try 5%. Trying to make a point here, and apparently I'm not going to do it until I get a positive NPV. Okay, and then alpha solve, this will give us. So, this is the net present value would be 3.80 million. So it's a positive net present value project, and we say go, okay? But what if you have to pay a fee to get this money? Suppose that your fee on this money is 10% of the money. So that would not be a negative 100 million. That would be a negative 110 million. And then the net present value becomes negative 6.20 million. The project is a no-go because just simply because of the financing costs of it. That's the killer, is that oftentimes the financing costs, a lot of projects, like I said, are positive net present value by a razor's edge. And once you include the financing costs, which is oftentimes not done up front, you realize, okay, this is not a good deal. We can't do the project under the conditions that are set forth. Here's the mystery. The financing costs for debt are relatively not too bad, usually unless you go to, or you're desperate enough to do a reorg specialist, and then you're at the mercy of the wolves. But in general, if you're issuing debt, I mean, 2.8%, 2.5%. Equity can be staggeringly expensive. So in other words, if I want to finance a project by selling common stock, that can knock you dead on your financing costs. Except for preferred stock. Oddly enough, preferred stock does not have a high financing cost at all. As a matter of fact, we oftentimes assume the float on preferred is zero, which leads to that mystery, why don't companies finance with preferred stock anymore? It's just not popular to finance with preferred stock these days. And so In other words, you're putting aside one of the cheaper ways that you could raise equity capital for a project. You would rather go with debt or with equity. Notice something else here. Remember I told you that the debt market is 10 times the size of the equity market? That's one of the reasons, is because debt is cheaper than equity as far as financing costs go. So you want to keep that in mind. If you are ever in a position where you are deciding how to finance a project, your first thing would be to ask yourself, okay, how is debt going to be? How much is it going to cost us to finance with debt? Okay, why don't we try preferred stock? You'll get shot down right away. Oh, no one uses preferred stock. Okay, then you want to do a big public fancy high-powered public offering of common stock. Well, that's got all that glitz and sex appeal and all that attention from the media, but it's also expensive as heck to pull it off. You've got lawyers, you've got accountants, you've got the investment bankers. Everyone's going to want to jump into that game and take a little bit of your money before you even see a dime of it. So you want to keep that in mind, though, that oftentimes projects look great. You get all your costs together, okay, cost of the equipment, cost of the land, cost of this and that, and you can find a positive net present value of the project, and then you go back and say, okay, how are we going to finance this? Well, we're going to use this much debt, this much equity. How much is that going to add to the cost of it? Well, it's going to knock you dead. Let me give you an even more realistic example, a slightly more realistic example here. The capital structure of your firm is 60% debt and 40% equity. Debt has financing costs of 2.5%, and equity has financing costs of 8%. You need $24 million for new projects. How much will the financing costs increase the total cost of your projects? Now remember that whenever you finance a project, you've got to finance it to keep yourself on your optimal capital structure. So in any event, what's going to happen here is that you're going to need debt. $24 million times 60% and equity, you will draw $24 million times 40%.
Really? That can't be too... $14.4 million.
And $9.6 million. So in other words, you're going to raise $14.4 million by issuing debt. And as far as equity goes, you will pull $9.6 million in equity. Now, the way equity works is like this. You've got the earnings of the company after your dividends. The first thing you're going to do is draw those down for the project. And once you've exhausted those, you'll sell more common stock for the rest of your equity. That's how it works. First, you use your internally generated equity. And then once you've exhausted that, you go to your externally generated equity. Now, so in other words, we're now going to say, all right, times for debt, 2.5%, and times for equity, 8%, and cranking that out, doing that, second quit, 14.4 times 2.025. So that's going to add 360,000. And 8%, 9.6 times 0.08, 0.768, 0.768 million. So, that adds $1.128 million to your project. In other words, divided by the $24 million, that adds almost 5% to the cost of the project. That can be a killer. That can be the showstopper. Like I said, if you're being realistic about your revenue projections, your costs, and all of that, the projects that are positive NPV are not going to usually be hugely positive NPV, because it just shouldn't happen that you are the only one who found an incredible project. So we're talking about something that can actually be the showstopper on financing a project, especially for a somewhat smaller company. With big companies, they'll get deals and discounts with the investment banking firms. Well, you do a lot of business with them. They have a lot of internal resources to get things ready that would cost a smaller company a lot of money to put together. So, I mean, this is more of a killer for small companies than it is for large companies. So you've got to keep this in mind. That's one of the big points that is made in Chapter 13 in the textbook, is that those financing costs can actually be change the cost of a project. Another interesting thing, and I'll tell you a fascinating story. And I actually did not grasp what this was about. I was teaching a class. I teach for the Management Development International. Our international studies program brings over actual practicing professionals from other countries, from Africa and South America, and we give them the advanced finance. Interestingly enough, oftentimes what I find out is that I'm teaching them what I teach you, even though these people have degrees. Their methods, the learning that they've had in their bachelor's degrees is very different. So I went through and I was teaching them, and I said, and I didn't know this until I had gotten into the program, well, what kind of a bank do you work at? Oh, they don't work for the banks. They're government people. They're in the financing of governments. In one specific case, one group, they worked for a government. They were citizens of an African country that's really trying its best to get on its feet and be part of the world of the 21st century, a good player. And they said, what we want to do is we want to become partners with private companies to invest in them for an equity stake, in an equity stake, so that we can get money into them to make them grow, to make them bigger and stronger. And I thought, well, this is kind of cool. This is interesting. So So I taught them about classic finding the incremental cash flows, looking at a company, finding out what its present value is, and if you put this money into it, what does that do to the return on equity, and all that kind of stuff. The stuff that I kind of teach you. And I said, okay, now, let me ask you this. And I was getting to this. This was where I was headed. Okay, financing costs. And I said, okay, and I had never looked at their bonds before. The government issues bonds, borrows money to do this. I said, well, that's kind of an interesting thing, public sector financing, because you don't have that technical equity, debt, optimal capital structure thing. So how much did you issue in bonds? Are you ready to spend on these companies? And they said, well, we got bonds at worth, this last bond issue was $750 million. Of course, I that took me so much by surprise, I lost my decorum. I said, God darn, that's a lot of money. And they just kind of looked at me, and I said, yeah, that's 750. I said, okay. So I pulled up the country's bonds and looked for the latest one. Okay. They issued the bonds. Now, understand that the rating services in Western Europe and in the United States are rating these as investment quality, real low investment quality, but they're not junk. And yet, they issued the bonds with that coupon. Now, have you gotten far enough in this course that you see that's an enormously big coupon? I mean, that was, and then, sure enough, these things went out the door in the sale at the staggering premiums to par because the coupon was so high compared to what the market said it should be. And I just said, my God, you got a lot of money. You didn't get $750 million. You got $750 million times 1.2. No, we didn't, because they gave us that value, and they kept the 20 points. Wait, what? In other words, they set the bond coupon staggeringly high so that they sold out at an enormous premium to par, but the government got only par on the bonds, and the additional 20% of $750 million went to the investment banking group that pulled the deal. You follow that? In other words, $150 million financing cost just because this government didn't understand how to, I don't even know if they could have accessed normal capital markets. But I mean, if I had done a deal like that, I would have been taken out and shot. But this is how it worked for this country. It is, in other words, carrying 20% more debt, paying that for 15 years, these were 15-year bonds, then it is getting money to invest for. So in other words, it has $750 million, but it is paying on $900 million of debt. That's what I mean by financing costs, except that's financing costs from hell on that country. And, of course, this was something that was going on, and I began to do some more research on it. And I found out, yeah, this is not that unusual. And, I mean, seriously, Morningstar was giving these bonds 4 stars. Standard & Poor's was putting them at a BBB rating. No, I'm sorry, a BB rating. So their investment quality, there is no way in the world 17.5% was justified, except that that was how they sold them at such a, that's how they could get them to sell at a premium to par from hell and skim off everything above par for the investment group that did the deal. And I made the mistake of asking them, all right, who was the investment group? And that nearly dropped my jaw, because it wasn't an investment group at all. It's one of the global banks that was set up to help countries crawl out of third world status. So there you are, kind of an interesting little side story. And I was so not expecting to see anything like that. Yeah, I know, right? That amazed me. But anyway, let me look at markets here for a little bit here. I won't say. But let me say this. I mean, seriously, I am pretty sure that in many countries, if I pulled a deal like that, I wouldn't be able to show my face in that country because of, you know, local customs with skinning people alive and, you know, burning them at the stake and all of that. That was just staggering what they're doing to these countries. As I told these people, look, Africa is going to be the China of this last half of the 21st century. China is already sagging, and Africa is going to rise. And sooner or later, they're going to crawl out, but it's going to take them a lot more to crawl out from under all of this excess financing, these excess financing costs. But they will come out of it, and they will not be colonialized. Like, essentially, what this is like a financial colonialism a la the 18th, 19th century, except now we're saddling them with debt to keep them under our thumb. And it won't work this time. There's just no other place after we've... Oh, well, anyway. Okay. Good day, bad day on the market, sir?
It was marginally good.
Marginally good. Pretty good. Madam, why? Why were the markets giddy today? Why were they all excited? Don't know? Don't know? Don't care. Ma'am? Okay, what was making the markets scared last week? Anything in particular was scaring the markets last week? Anything? Well, this one kind of impacts you because if we do go to a war, you will be the meat on the battlefield, okay? And I'll get to watch you. We had done a series of airstrikes in Syria, and there was a very big concern that this was a prelude to an escalating war that we would be sucked into very quickly. And then there was saber rattling. Russia was all miffed at us, and we were blustering and all that. It was all show, though, because we didn't hit any strategic targets, and Russia knew that we didn't, so they threatened us, and we threatened more strikes, and everyone's happy now. We can all go home and scratch our armpits and say, yeah, we taught them a lesson. That's why the market is not happy. Is happy now is that it wasn't a prelude to war at all. It was just a show. And so the markets that were down last week because of the potential of going straight into a quagmire a la Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan wasn't anything but just a PR show. So the markets bounced back very handsomely. Everyone's happy now. We blew up some abandoned airfields. We blasted some empty tanks that had sarin gas and chlorine in them. Good news. Except... let's look at the yield curve. 7 and 10s are right here. Going back to last week, 7-point spread, 6, 6, 7, rut-row, 5, 5, 5. The gap is closing very slowly. But the inversion it's getting there. And like I said, it won't instantly. It'll bounce back a little bit, might come back to 6 or 7. Then it'll narrow to 5 again, and then we'll see 4. Recession isn't going to be called until we see the rate on the 7 go above the rate on the 10. But it's moving there at its own pace, which drives you crazy. Because you'd say, will you just please announce the apocalypse and be done with it? No, it's not going to do it that way. But as you can see, we are now down to a five basis point spread between the 7 and the 10. So inversion is moving, it's moving toward its inversion, but it's not there yet. Brief mention. Market discipline. My 349 class, Advanced Financial Theory and Problems, I introduced them to a series of dramatic scandals, bad things, all the stuff that is the dark side of our business, finance. Companies that do wrong, banks that screw millions of customers, destroy the lives of whistleblowers, fix prices, and cause economies to go to hell in a handbasket. Scoundrels who set up and then wreck entire nations and become multi-billionaires in the process. So I asked them, you do a presentation. I give them a whole list of articles. Find one of these topics. Read four or five articles about it, and then you're going to do a five-minute, seven-minute video presentation for me. This is on these online class. And the last question I ask them is, okay, here's the term, market discipline. Versus government regulation. Any field of business is going to be conservative. I meet more liberal people in marketing, but underneath it, they are probably, what they do is the most conservative of all of us in terms of the cutthroat manipulation of humans. But we're conservatives, and we would say, all right, the government does not need to regulate modern financial institutions because we can take care of ourselves. If something is wrong, once we find out about it, we will punish the companies. We will sell the stock price will drop dramatically, the board of directors will step in and fire executive management that was responsible for it. For what happened. We don't need the government to tell us what to do. We will punish our own. We will take care of our own problems. Can anyone think of a company in the last few days that has gotten itself into hot water with a scandal? Anyone? No company? Say what?
Starbucks.
Yeah. Starbucks. Starbucks did probably one of the most insanely bad PR moves. It wasn't the main company's fault, but it was something that caused a major social upheaval in the social media. See if the market had anything to say about Starbucks.
Okay.
Yes. No, that's what market discipline means. The market will discipline its own. They will take companies out and they will spank them for doing things that are bad. Did Starbucks get spanked today? Now that's obviously anecdotal evidence. But the idea that markets step right and say, don't do that, we're going to punish you. Time after time, you look at companies and the scandals that they get themselves, the hot water they get into, and it just doesn't seem to have much of an impact on the overall behavior of the market. All we care about is what's this going to do to the cash flow, and the assessment of the market is people are still going to go in and have their Starbucks. They might bitch, they might complain, they might cry, they might be morally outraged, but until they show that they will not have that over-roasted Starbucks coffee served by baristas who look like they are worn to the bone, well, there's not going to be any market discipline to change the culture. Let me do one here real quick. I got to check something because I might be. Okay, Unilever. Let's look at Unilever. Does anyone know the... Oh, shut up. God! I thought that was the Lord telling me it's time to go. Does anyone know the scandal with Unilever, the unbelievable one? Can you summarize it?
Is it the one with the shirts?
Yes.
Well, they have that one, but then they also have another one they did beforehand.
They don't learn. I mean, and then there's still, okay, do all of you know what Dove did? That they had African-American woman who removed one of her overlying shirts and she was a Caucasian under it. Dove does that for you. Now, can you be that stupid? I mean, can you be that insensitive? That's the year to date. Looks like I was punished for being that stupid. No, that's the problem, is that the concept of market discipline versus market government regulation. Markets don't care. If you are looking for a field where there is sentiment and understanding of issues that go beyond the bottom line, the money itself, then don't look into finance because that's not what we do. All we do is say, are people going to be outraged enough that they'll stop buying the product in huge numbers? No. We're probably going to, with Starbucks, have a few people who won't go there for a week or two, and then they'll be right back. And so the market discipline aspect of our arguments against government regulation just seem to not have any particularly strong evidence in the stock prices. We don't see executives being fired. We don't see them having huge, deep internal reforms. Google is in the throes of a wild disclosure about the unbelievable practices that have been going on with respect to discrimination, workplace harassment and all that. It's not doing a thing to Google's price whatsoever, even though there are article after article about what's been happening. Lawsuits are pouring out, just the cost of business. Now, I just wanted to bring this up because at the end of this course, I want to make sure you understand how we think in finance. And the last thing about this is one other thing I do want to bring up here. I'm going to save part of this lecture for Wednesday. But we're there. Okay, now. Test where you are. Ma'am, you have a friend who's recommended a couple of stocks. He said you really should buy these. As a matter of fact, he said, I bought these last year, and I've made quite a bit of money on those investments. So now you should do this. Give me two reasons why. And all of you should listen to this because this is the kind of thing that I ask on tests. He last year I invested in these last year, and I've been making some good money. And I recommend that you buy these stocks. Give me two reasons why you should not listen to him. Or give me one, and I'll ask someone else. If you can give me one, I'll let you off the hook. That's very good. Okay. You're struggling there. You said the right thing. First of all, buying naked stocks, just single stocks, is a very bad idea because you're bearing all that extra risk that wouldn't be there in a diversified portfolio. That's a definite, absolutely, absolutely. And that's actually the core answer. Just say, I don't buy stocks on their own. I buy stocks in the context of a portfolio. Now, you could look at these stocks in context of your portfolio, but one thing you would want to make sure is, even if you were to say yes to these, before you said that, you would want to check the correlations of those stocks, what he had recommended, against the correlations of the stocks that are already in your portfolio. Because if those are high correlations with what's already in there, they're going to do nothing for your portfolio whatsoever. Another part of that has to do, okay, well, there are actually a number of answers. Now, understand that in a question like this, there are more than a couple of right answers. And then there are some answers that are just so wrong. I had a student say, well, why is this wrong? Well, because it sucks. Ma'am. Give me another reason. Give me a reason why you would not listen to him. Anything you've learned in here about it? Got nothing?
Yeah. No. I mean, just
because you don't know. Come on, talk.
Oh, without looking up the stock beforehand?
There, you're on the right track. No, the point is, how the hell are you? Wait, you mean you're God? I'm sorry. Just because some hoe handle says this is a great stock, how do you know that? You have enough education now in my class, thank God you took me for a professor, that you can actually look at the stock yourself. No, I'm not going to jump on it. I'll have a look at it, but I'm probably going to make a different conclusion than you are. Good. Now, there's one that's somewhat related to that. But it's a little more detailed, but it's also a little bit different. Talk to me. Anything that you have to say to this guy? Well, there. You're coming around it. Look, he's talking about historical performance. He's not talking about future performance. Well, I made this much money last year. Well, yeah, I was a lot better looking last year than I am now. I mean, damn, age is getting to me. You know? And the point there is that he's talking about a historical thing. And stocks, history doesn't matter to stock prices. It just doesn't. No matter how much we say that, we have all these people who say, well, we'll look at the history of this stock and decide on it from the history. No. You got to look forward. You look at the financials, but then you keep asking yourself, what is about to happen? Okay, not what has already happened. It kind of goes with that thing, never mind what you did for me, what are you going to do for me? That's all I care about. Another one. Got anything else on this one? In other words, if I were to ask a question like this, I'd ask you for a very good one reason of the ones that I'm giving you. But you'd have to give me what it is that I'm looking for in a good, detailed way. Talk to me. Anything else that you've got in your thoughts about this? Sir, anything at all? I don't use the word stupid. I use words like ignorant, dumbass, DF. Not stupid. People get lucky, okay? I mean, in any given month, someone wins the lottery. That doesn't mean that someone was a genius. That person, have you ever noticed that people who win the lottery, they look like trailer trash? I mean, they look like they barely made it through the GED, and that was with a cheat sheet. Now I'm a billionaire, by God. Oh, Lord, another one. There's no reason to believe he's a genius. I mean, but also a couple of other things that have to do with this, too, is these stocks could be of a beta that is not in your profile. I mean, you could be looking at something that is extraordinarily high beta. Now, you understand that you can take a stock with a high beta, which means that it has an insane amount of total risk, and you might actually see a decent return on that because the beta is so high on it, but that doesn't mean that that's a good idea, because as much as you can expect a return that is extraordinary, you can also expect to become poor beyond extraordinary on those kinds of stocks. So it might not be even a beta that's in your, you might be a beta of, let's say, a 0.9. But if you did that research, you'd see that beta was 1.8. That's not even a wise investment for you, even in a well-diversified portfolio. That security would not be. So that's something that you also have to keep in mind, too. And it all boils down to this, then. Let me summarize it somewhat for you. First and foremost, is the history does not tell you the future. We should study history because social and political markets are not efficient. That's why we need to understand history in a large context. History with stock prices, though, does not tell us much at all about what's going to happen next. And anyone who makes a recommendation to you, you have to ask, what are your credentials? How successful are you? Why are you telling me this? Why are you sharing your secrets for success with someone like me? That always should be in your mind. Whenever someone tells you an inside secret, many, many traders back in my time, we would sucker punch people all the time. We'd take away their money by giving them our confidence. And that's what con men do. We give our confidence. We show that we trust you with this interesting information on the inside. And then when you get blown away, you go crying, but you don't dare to say anything to the government because you were willing to participate in an insider trade. Does that sound mean? Yes, but it bought us an extra martini at lunch, and those are expensive when you're on Wall Street. Does that sound cruel? You think about that the next time you decide to play in the big leagues. It can be a very bad experience for you because there are people like me in it, or what I was in that business. Okay, the other one is appropriateness of the investment. Is this beta appropriate for you? Also, you need to ask yourself what this does in a well-diversified portfolio, not what it does on its own, because you really can't care about that kind of thing. And just as a general rule, don't trust someone who just says, I made a lot of money. Yes, he could be lying, or he could have been lucky. It doesn't matter. What matters is to maintain a disciplined disciplined investment pattern, because otherwise you're subject to the people like me out there. And as I had once many years ago when I would visit my relatives in the summer in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, when I'd leave, there was this old man. He'd come up and he'd look out at me and say, you be careful out there. The world is full of Englishmen. Well, in your case, you be careful out there because the world is full of finance professionals. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.